Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show, Danielle.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, now it seems the U.S. Debt ceiling thing is pretty well over. Was this another case of full of sound and fury signifying nothing?
Well, I mean, I said that, you know, all along, that I've seen this now pretty much every year almost, or every couple of years, and they've done it more than 100 times in the last 80 years where they've increased the debt limit. So it wasn't really a function or question of whether they would. It was more about the grandstanding and extortion for what each side would be able to ratchet out of the other in the process. So the fact that they seem to be come to terms now is great. We can get on with more pressing matters that are more significant than that one. The immediate impacts of it being more fiscal and monetary contraction. I was trying to describe that on the blog this week. The reality being that we already have this contracting money supply globally, which is manifesting itself in the form of a decline in the credit that's available in the economy, both in terms of what's offered and in terms of demand for credit is plummeting. And that is a function of the monetary tightening that's gone on so dramatically the past year, which has extracted cash out of the financial system. And it has moved money, as we've spoke before, from things like bank accounts where people were earning nothing towards, money market funds or high interest savings funds. And these things, so that's coming out of the banking system. So that's one of the factors that's causing this contraction in credit. The other aspect of this deal is it's a fiscally contractive deal, and that's because they have agreed on a spending cap for the next 2 years. And much of the growth that we've seen in GDP the past, 2 years, 3 years since the pandemic has been from the government sector. That's the case in Canada as well as in the U.S. But for the spending and the extra debt that was added in order to pump money into the economy, into households and businesses, you would have seen, much more dire GDP or economic momentum in the economy. And so now when we're looking at the largest economy in the world, being the United States, the most significant consumption driver in the world, having a fiscal deal, which means they have to spend less in the next 2 years, that is a contraction on the fiscal side. But on top of that, given the fact that they drew down the government coffers so starkly in the last 5 months in order, because we've been, they've been coming to this debt limit, the end of the debt ceiling agreement for, and have had to negotiate this for some time. In the process, Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, was allowing the cash on reserve at the government bank to be drawn down to fund spending. Well, now that we've come to this deal, what they essentially have to do is replenish the coffers. And that in itself means selling, more than $1 trillion of T-bills. And people don't think of it this way if you're not in financial markets, perhaps. But when the government sells bonds or T-bills, they take up cash out of the system. So in other words, you give them cash in order to buy this investment or this place to park money where you're currently being paid interest rates above 5%. So that's pretty attractive. So there's an uptake, there's an interest, there's a demand for these issuances, these T-bills, but the effect of it is it takes cash out of the banking and investment system. So it takes money that might otherwise have gone into things like equities or into real estate and puts it in these short-term T-bills earning, you know, interest at the least possible capital risk. So all those factors together suggest to me that, you know, it's interesting, the economic data has continued to become quite moribund in the last few months. It continued this week with the ISM manufacturing numbers, you know, contracting in the U.S. for the seventh consecutive month. You've got retail sales disappointing to the downside. You have home prices having the biggest drop in over a decade. You've got investor purchases in things like, you know, the real estate market down about 50% year over year. So all of those things are just, again, this idea that there's less capital willing and able to go into these riskier classes. And I think this deal is going to make that even more pronounced. At the same time, you know, it wasn't coincidental, I think, that we had the U.S. Fed have a couple of their members come out this week and start talking about the prospects of a skip. This was a new word. We always look for new nomenclature, right? So I've been talking for some time about mind the pause, because when historically the central banks say, okay, we've cut enough, like the Bank of Canada did in January, they said, okay, we think we've hiked interest rates enough. We'll wait and see how that goes, because they know that there's this lag of 12 to 18 months before any change in monetary policy ultimately filters through the economy. So this, you know, the Bank of Canada said, they didn't say we're stopping forever, but they said we're going to pause and see how it goes. Well, the U.S. Fed has been saying, even in the last, up until this month, you know, well, we don't think we've hiked enough. We think inflation is going to be sticky. We think there's going to be a reason to keep tightening as we head into, you know, the summer. And the futures market was pricing in a 0.25 hike at the June meeting coming up, and potentially another one in July. Well, in the last couple of days, all these factors that I'm describing about contracting liquidity and the negative data, you have now, you know, some Fed speakers coming out saying, perhaps we can skip the June meeting. Let's just take a break. And we're not going to call it a pause, but let's just take a break and see how much the tightening that we have done is ultimately already slowing the consumption and impacting inflation. And importantly, Jim, the unemployment rate. So this comes back to what we've spoken about many times, unemployment being a lagging indicator. It's the last thing to sort of move from the peak of a business cycle into a contraction, because people cut back on hours worked and temporary employment and the average work week, all that sort of thing. Those are leading indicators of the employment cycle, and we've seen them falling now for several months. So the next phase of this is where you get the unemployment rate officially spiking up, and that's typically when the U.S. Fed or the central banks say, okay, we better, you know, stay on the sidelines here. We've tightened enough, clearly. Our mandate of keeping inflation low is now in direct conflict with our other mandate of keeping unemployment low. So something's got to give, and typically you end up seeing them move to cutting rates within months afterwards. Now, financial markets, on the other hand, see this as, oh, a pause, a U.S. debt deal, great, all clear. And historically, it's not at all an all-clear signal. It's a signal that the worst is now going to unfold, both in the economy, unemployment, and ultimately in things like equities.
Yeah, now, the way the Fed runs the economy, I kind of liken it to driving your car forward, but steering it by looking into the rearview mirror.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, they have this terrible history of being completely obtuse or irrelevant in terms of real nowcasting, in terms of seeing things that are coincident or are forward-looking. Again, one of the reasons is they've been given this mandate about unemployment. Well, unemployment is the most lagging indicator. So if you're only concerned about not moving to cut until you see the unemployment rate start to hike or start to raise, and you know that any cuts that you go to make, just like any hikes that you're making in terms of interest rates, any cuts you go to make are not going to be felt through the economy for 12 to 18 months. So when you realize that, you say, oh my God, they've been given these very crude tools indeed, and yet all hopes are placed on them as some kind of, magicians or miracle workers. And indeed, all they end up doing is creating boom-bust cycles because they put in so much, they accentuate or enable the credit creation so much from the lows in the cycle where they've got rates down to virtually nothing, especially in the last 20 years. It used to be they would cut rates by an average of 400 basis points, so maybe from a rate of something like 6 to 2 and leave it there for a few months and then, within a year start raising rates again. That was the typical cycle. In the last 20 years, what we've seen is an increasingly more desperate effort where they put in too much credit and liquidity. Financial markets are completely unregulated in many, many areas and many important ways that they are allowed to run amok. All this speculation happens. And then, they leave, the crash is profound and they leave rates at next to nothing for a very long time. And that allows the whole bubble formation to start over. And then every time, people talk about leverage as this gift that gives in terms of the expansion of asset prices. But unfortunately, the thing that comes with that is the opposite, which is the collapse of asset prices is always greater when you've got highly leveraged cycles. So again, the central banks are not magicians. They're just people with crude tools that are being imbued with these, Wizard of Oz powers that they don't ultimately have.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, are people who invested in condos in big trouble?
By all accounts, it seems like things are getting quite nasty, yes. I mean, condos have become the go-to rental product in the past number of years, especially in large centers where individual or, purpose-built rentals were sort of in short supply, and it was all about the investor class, right? The investor class was going to save the day by bringing all this supply. Well, ultimately, the investor class, the funds, again, you get a decade of ultra-low interest rates and really lax lending standards, and you certainly saw a ton of money flow into particularly things like condos in big cities in all over the world, really, but in Canada for sure, in the greater Toronto and Vancouver areas primarily. And we had the highest number of skyscrapers in North America building these projects in Toronto. And when you look at what was happening as rates went, lower and lower to nothing, people were buying them with less and less down, were buying them, by borrowing on one property to buy another three, flipping contracts without even having, just purchasing the right to purchase. So this derivative, sort of exposure to real estate and then hoping to sell the contract before they have to actually close. And of course, there's a couple or 3 years of build time between the initial, infusion or purchase and the final completion. And because of that cycle, it's typical to see, real estate cycles tend to move over 3 to 6 years in terms of turning points. And so we've got a bunch of properties now coming on market in the next year or so into a market in Toronto where the rents are no longer able to keep up with the prices people paid. That on top of the interest rates, which tripled in the last year, on top of things like property taxes, which are going up significantly in many cities, again, because they're backward-looking too, right? So property taxes tend to be based on a a past market value, and as that market value goes through a bubble and it goes up a lot, eventually 2 or 3 years after that peak, you start to see municipalities and other rate agencies use those market values to increase property taxes. So all that really is hitting at a time when, you know, the data, there was a CIBC report this week that came out showing that, you know, in 2020, the majority of people who are buying these condos to rent out were barely breaking even. I wrote about that in our month-end letters to clients, you know, over the last couple of years. But just basically, the math didn't make any sense. There was no buffer in there for, you know, a period of vacancy or, God forbid, if you needed a repair or some special assessment on the building. There was no buffer in that because the rents were barely enough to cover because the prices were so overblown. And then in 22, people were literally, the average was losing money per month. It was a negative carry asset, and that got even worse in the last year as interest rates tripled. So when you look at that, you realize that most of these people, and you'll hear it from realtors and mortgage brokers, they'll say, well, sure, they're negative carry. You're having to, you know, put money in each month to carry the property because the rents don't cover it, but we're not worried because, you know, the price appreciation in itself is going to be enough, more than enough, to, you know, pay you back in the end for this negative carry or outlays that you do over the ownership period. Well, what if that's not the case? What if property prices, in fact, fulfill their normal pattern, which is to spend 3 to 6 years in decline? And if you think about it, we've only been in about, you know, our decline in Canada has only started from about February of 22, which was the peak. So we're, say, you know, something like 14 or 15 months into this decline. What if prices continue to weaken and go down as new supply comes on market over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years? Well, how long will these people that are having the negative carry want to continue to hold these properties that they're having to subsidize while prices are visibly dropping in front of their eyes? Another piece that I think is not mentioned enough, and I've been watching this story for some time, Jim, is this idea of how hard is it going to be to get property insurance, you know, coverage on a lot of properties in many parts of the world today. For example, Canada has, you know, the most wildfires that we've seen in a long time, both on the east and the west coast in northern Ontario, but also in places like California. State Farm this week announced that it will no longer insure new homes in California because of wildfire risk. So this is kind of this, you know, whether you believe in climate change or not, the math of it is that the extreme weather events have been ratcheting up at, you know, an incredible rate in the past few years, and that's projected to continue. At some point, you know, we're used to floods and hurricanes and now wildfires. And I was thinking to myself, how much of our net worth are we going to want to have in expensive abodes if we cannot get property insurance for them? So, you know, a major player like State Farm leaving a major market, that's the tipping edge. You're starting to see it in places like Florida, where in some of the flood areas and the hurricane-prone areas, insurance is not available. You can't get it, or you can only get it at such an extreme level that people can't afford it. So how about this as a tipping point in the mentality around housing or real estate, you know, that you can't insure that asset? So it seems to me the natural inclination is to then have less money in those properties or assets which can't be insured against catastrophic loss. So I think this is part of the, you know, not just in terms of how to get more efficient, which is essential for things like energy consumption, but also outlay. You know, in a world where people are over-levered and overexposed to things like real estate, too much of their net worth is in these assets, whether they're negative carry because they're personal consumption, you know, so you're not actually being paid anything, you're paying to live in that house. Even if it's paid off, you have negative carry to live in a property. Now imagine that you can't have it insured or you can't afford to have insurance on it. And I think you're going to see a migration in people from these areas of high risk, but also just overall in terms of having probably, you know, smaller, less expensive places, maybe diversified in more areas just to hedge your bets a bit. And I don't think this is a theme or an idea that is widely appreciated yet, but I think it's going to be with us now for the next number of years, and that could have a pretty significant impact on decisions people are making in terms of allocations to that asset class.
Is AI mania helping disguise the problems facing the U.S. stock market?
Oh yeah, for sure. So we have, you know, again, this I've mentioned, this is similar to the mania we saw in 2000, very much similar, where back then NVIDIA was also a, you know, quote, hot stock, a hot tech stock. But, you know, people get wind of this new concept, this new tech area, and in this case, artificial intelligence, and all of a sudden, everyone and their dog is mentioning AI on their earnings calls. You know, companies are trying to include the phrase in their press releases so that investors will get excited or attracted to them and start buying up their particular securities. And what you get is absolutely mindless behaviors where, you know, yes, AI chips that NVIDIA makes, they have a huge market share of that, but other companies are coming along fast. And, you know, when you're trading at, I mean, it changes, the stock's been going up 25% a day in some cases, but, you know, when you're trading at 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 times sales, which is the case for many of these companies now, just because people are assuming they're going to be in this hot sector, so they're, you know, buy them at any price is kind of the idea. What you typically get then is that, you know, a disappointing decade or more where prices tumble and investors that thought they were buying, you know, these smart things end up losing money and abandoning with losses after prices come off significantly. So it's just the latest kind of, you know, and I think it's partly algorithm driven. How ironic is this, that AI or algorithm-driven, you know, computer program models have been buying up based on headlines, which are largely derived or created by algorithm machines themselves. So you've got this kind of crazy dance right now that's going on between every time a headline hits, you know, you get a bunch of computerized trading, high-frequency trading that can drive up the prices of things. And then as we saw today with, you know, a lot of the economic data actually gets revised significantly. So this is something that humans know. If you're very astute as a financial analyst, you appreciate that a lot of the economic data that comes out is based on estimates, guesstimates, forward-looking, you know, factors, which often typically prove to be too optimistic. That's the bias, is to be too optimistic rather than too pessimistic for the masses. And so it's quite common to see these numbers revised significantly lower. So, for example, we saw that today with the labor productivity growth and related measures in the U.S., you know, output and the gains that were, you know, this goes back to AI, people assuming, oh, well, when we have our computer help, we're going to be so much more efficient. And the estimation of that is, you know, forward-looking. And then you see the data come in, and it's like, oh, wow, we actually were less efficient, less productive. That's going to hurt profits, that's going to hurt output, GDP, all of it. And it gets revised down after the fact. Well, these algorithms seem to be completely reactionary. In other words, they don't do any of that kind of wisdom-based assessment or realization that some of the numbers are just farce and will be completely reversed. And so we've kind of got a mess now where the machines are supposed to be, you know, knowing the cutting-edge information, but they're actually just trading as crazy as any human would, based on biases and misinformation.
If, and I was going to say, too, for a lot of traders, they've never been in a situation like this with hyperinflation underway like it was back in the late 70s, early 80s. How to trade in situations like that, how to prevent losing your shirt over it. Is that a problem as well? Because they're the ones programming these machines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're, you know, I saw Jamie Dimon came out with one of my favorites, Jamie Dimon, head of JP Morgan. You know, he came out with a comment this week that they are planning to replace financial advisors at the bank with algorithms or these artificial intelligent artificial intelligence. And I thought, well, that won't be hard to do because all they ever want their financial advisors to do is advise people to buy risky assets that the bank produces in exchange for their cash. Well, you can certainly program an algorithm to do the same thing. There's no wisdom in either entity. There's no risk management in either entity. So, of course, they could replace them and still have the same and you know, pay not have to pay the AI what they pay the financial advisors. So lucrative for the bank. But there's no prospect of better results for the customer in that whole scenario because you know, that requires a lot more big picture thinking, a lot more non-sales driven insights about how to, you know, get people into strong financial positions that involve, you know, paying off debt, which means not borrowing from the banks who are trying to recommend the debt to people, and not having a ton of money in high risk assets, especially near cycle peaks like we have today. So I don't think that the piece that's required for long-term strength and stability, the discipline piece, the wisdom piece, the awareness of human biases, I don't think that's ever going to go out of style or be superfluous or in wide supply, quite honestly, because it's just not as sexy or lucrative as a sales tool.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Hey, thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.